You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 14th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, Lebanon's former Prime Minister vows to return with a message from Saudi Arabia. So who is he really working for and what is the Saudi regime up to? We could ask the same question about Zimbabwe, where the head of the army has threatened the ruling party, who in turn have accused him of treason. We'll get the latest from Harare. Russia looks set to put more pressure on foreign media operating inside its borders. We'll ask what impact it's likely to have. And later we'll hear from an award-winning director getting inside the minds of some of the world's most violent criminals. Plus a look at the big stories across Asia, and we'll draw up a list of New York suspect statues. All in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. First, though, a quick look at some of the day's other top news stories. And for the first time in decades, the US Congress is examining the president's authority to launch a nuclear attack. Some members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee have raised concerns that Donald Trump could irresponsibly order a nuclear strike. It's after he threatened to unleash fire and fury on North Korea over the summer. His supporters say the president must be able to act without approval from lawyers. Iran's president has promised to find the culprits responsible for buildings collapsing after a powerful earthquake on the border with Iraq. More than 400 people are thought to have been killed and more than 8,000 injured in the quake. Hassan Rouhani has been to the affected area, promising help for the thousands of people left homeless. The UN has condemned the EU over its policy of helping Libya to intercept migrants and return them to detention. Officials described it as inhuman. UN monitors who visited facilities said they found thousands of emancipated and traumatized men, women, and children. Almost three times more people are in detention now than just 2 months ago. And a sumo wrestling grand champion has apologised for causing trouble after allegedly hitting a fellow wrestler over the head with a beer bottle. Hadamu Fuji is accused of attacking rival Takanoya, who was left in hospital for several days. It's the latest scandal to hit the world of sumo. Last year, it emerged one wrestler was abused so badly that he lost the sight in one eye. Welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. First of all, Lebanon's former Prime Minister says he intends to return to the country this week. Saad al-Hariri stood down a little over a week ago, citing a threat to his life if he remained in office. He's now in Saudi Arabia, the nation that is accused of creating the crisis. It comes on top of the continuing civil war in Yemen, the hundreds of arrests in a corruption probe, and the seeming battle for power at the top of the Saudi regime. So what is going on in Riyadh? And more importantly, why is it happening? Well, joining me to discuss that is Hanin Gada, who is now the Friedman Visiting Fellow at the Washington Institute and is a longtime managing editor of Lebanon's Now News website. Let's start with Lebanon, if we may. Mr. Hariri's been speaking in an interview which has shed a little more light on what happened around his resignation.
Since his resignation, Hariri gave one interview, which was this past weekend. But there are three interesting things that I think he said during this interview. One, he mentioned Yemen a lot. He mentioned Hezbollah's interference in Yemen and Iran interference in Yemen. Two, he kind of hinted that at the possibility of him backing off his resignation if things change. Three, he said that he might be able to come back to Lebanon in a couple of days, and a couple of days could mean a few days in Lebanese terms. So he is coming back to Lebanon, apparently, to meet with the president and to discuss Hezbollah's interference in Yemen. That's what was the main interesting points of this interview. So we're waiting for that. We don't know what's going to happen, but most probably people are expecting him to come back to Lebanon, and he's going to get a very huge welcome by everyone. It's going to be a great welcoming party by everyone. And then he's going to go and meet with the president. And he's going to tell the president that he's going to give the president a Saudi message saying that Hezbollah's interference in Yemen affairs or Iran's interference in Yemen affairs is not acceptable for the Saudis. And you, as president of Lebanon, we will have to go and tell Hezbollah to stop that. And we know that, one, Michel Aoun is Hezbollah's ally, and he wouldn't be a president without Hezbollah. Two, he cannot really pressure Hezbollah to do anything. If anything, it's the other way around.
I'm drawn to something you said a moment ago. You said that that Mr. Hariri, who resigns, goes to Saudi Arabia, returns from Saudi Arabia to Lebanon, goes to see the president with a message from Saudi Arabia. It's not unreasonable mm-hmm. to then ask for whom the Lebanese prime minister is actually working, because it doesn't sound like he's working for the Lebanese people.
Well, he's definitely the prime minister of Lebanon, and his resignation came from Riyadh, so definitely it was a Saudi decision. Everybody's analyzing the obvious, I think, you know, whether he's a hostage or not. This is not really the issue. The issue is that his decision is not his decision anymore. He went to Riyadh, and he was asked to resign, and that's what he did. And he's coming back with the Saudi message and with instructions to do this. So yes, definitely, he's definitely following Saudi instructions so far. So is he going to be able to come back and say, I'm going to be the prime minister no matter what, and we're going to go back to everything as usual and as if nothing happened? No, definitely not. It's a new era. Lebanon is now open to the Saudi-Iran confrontation, and no one can stop it at this point. Hariri is irrelevant in this scenario.
The U.S. has warned Saudi Arabia not mm-hmm. to use other countries in the region to fight
yes.
proxy wars, and is obviously talking more about Lebanon than Yemen, because the U.S., while
yes.
expressing concerns about Yemen, hasn't mm-hmm. directly, aggressively intervened to tell the Saudis to stop the civil war
yes.
there. Is that going to have any impact in Riyadh?
Yes, absolutely. When this came from the State Department, it was one thing, but when this came from the White House, it was more definitive. And the Saudi got the message that the U.S. is not going to be on board with any war that the Saudis are going to start. And the Saudis are not going to start a war on their own. They're already in Yemen, and this is going to getting more complicated. And they're not going to start a war on their own. What they were hoping for is that the U.S.-led coalition, an anti-ISIS coalition in Syria mostly, but in Syria and Iraq, will change at one point its mission and maybe its composition to become an anti-Iran coalition. That's what they were hoping for, to start like a war against Iran. And this will draw everybody on board. This is what they were hoping for, I think. But obviously, these statements show that Lebanon is not going to be part of any war, and also the U.S. is not going to be part of this. Like, no one really wants to fight this war, because this war is going to be a war against Iran, and it's different, completely different from a war against ISIS. So what everybody expecting now to happen is a war in terms of like a military war, probably today is far-fetched. It's not something that is expected. But after Hariri comes back to Lebanon and maybe probably submits his resignation in person, then it will be Hezbollah will lose any cover, government cover or Sunni cover in the upcoming phase. And this means that the Saudis might actually start an economic war on Lebanon, the way they're doing with behaving with Qatar or Yemen. So basically, not a military war, but economic war is very possible, because the economic ties between Lebanon and the Saudis are very strong. We're talking about 350,000 Lebanese working only in Saudi Arabia. We have a lot of Saudi investments in Lebanon, and we have also Saudi deposits in the Lebanese Central Bank. So there's a lot at stake here. If Saudi Arabia decided to go for economic war on Lebanon, this is really, Qatar can survive this. Other countries might be able to survive this, but Lebanon will definitely not survive this. And on Hezbollah, yes, it's going to be an issue for Hezbollah, because they will lose the government cover and the Sunni cover they had with Hariri, and that's why they really want him back. Every single media backed by Hezbollah today is all about loving Hariri and expressing, you know, all these, you know, like, we're all Hariri and we want Hariri back, because they really want him back. So this is going to be an issue for Hezbollah. But the problem is that Hezbollah has a parallel economy in Lebanon. They are tied to the Lebanese economy, but they've always survived economic hardships because they have their own separate economic channels coming from Iran and their own investments. So So they might be able to survive this. Politically, they might be more prone to, you know, international sanctions. But Lebanon is not going to survive this. The Lebanese people are going to be, it's going to be very hard for them to survive this.
Hanin, thank you very much for your insight this evening. That's Hanin Agada from the Washington Institute. Next, what is going on in Zimbabwe? Tanks were earlier seen heading towards the country's capital, the day after the head of the armed forces warned he could step in to end a purge of people close to the sacked vice president. Constantine Chiwenga openly threatened to intervene in Zimbabwean politics a week after the man who is widely seen as Robert Mugabe's most likely successor was fired. Well, tonight he has been accused of treasonable conduct by Zimbabwe's ruling party. Well, for more, we can speak to Grace Mutandwa, who's a writer based in Harare. ZANU-PF say that the comments by the head of the army were calculated to incite insurrection. Now, accusing the head of the army of treason, you assume, is only going to make this situation even more tense.
It is likely to make this situation tense because clearly right now there is a sense of unease and tension. But for most of the day, people have been generally going ahead with their business. If you look at social media, you would believe that there was some upheaval actually right now, but it's not as like that.
Well, there were these reports of tanks on the streets earlier and some sort of fairly fevered rumours that a military coup was imminent, but it was actually just a handful of military vehicles. So what has actually happened today?
There were a handful of military vehicles on the streets, but to be honest with you, they could be soldiers that are actually aligned to the president, because from what we've been gathering, there is a division in within the military. There have been social media messages that are aimed at actually encouraging this sort of idea that Mnangagwa has got the military behind him, all the military, the armory behind him. But it might not be like that. Right now we are waiting to see what happens within the next 24 hours, because that's what's going to decide the future of Zimbabwe. And the fact that the Minister of Information, who is also Publicity Secretary for ZANU-PF, Simon Kayamoyo, issued a statement saying that what Chiwenga did was treasonous, means that they might be actually preparing to charge him.
Well, exactly. And presumably, if they are going to charge the head of the army with treason or something similar to treason, that will also involve removing him from his post. And if the military is considering making a move against Mugabe, that presumably means that they would have to make that move.
If that move was going to be made, it should have been made already. But the way I see things is that if Mugabe is still in control, then they are certainly going to charge Wenger with treason. And most soldiers would likely not even stand by Chiwenga, because with the way things happen in ZANU-PF is that once someone is out, some of the people will try and hide behind the idea of survival and keep quiet, stay quiet until the whole situation is cleared.
Now, the military have said that the events of the last week, with the sacking of the vice president and then a purge of some of his supporters, was an attempt to push the veterans of the Zimbabwean independence struggle out of any position of power and prepare the ground for Robert Mugabe's wife to take over.
There's clearly a division between the old guard and the new entrants into politics, Grace Mugabe included. And the war veterans have always declared that they would not salute anyone who didn't go to war. And Grace Mugabe didn't go to war. Most of the young people in ZANU-PF who would like to also be leaders tomorrow didn't go to war. So there's clearly a division there. But if they haven't moved already, they might actually be outmaneuvered by Robert Mugabe.
Now, you say that the younger members of ZANU-PF, who were also not involved in the war, are the ones who are very supportive of Grace Mugabe. And the head of the youth wing said that some of those members were, in his words, prepared to die to defend the leadership. Now, that coupled with some of the words of the head of the army, again, just makes you feel like this situation could quite quickly deteriorate into something even worse.
Yes, if the situation is not contained, it could deteriorate because both sides are trying to show how much power they wield. And whoever blinks first will lose.
And all this comes before an election next year, which may well be Mugabe's first without having the explicit support of the military. Although, of course, the likelihood is he will now impose a head of the army who is more supportive of him.
Yeah, but when you look at the situation, half the time the top guys in the military are the ones who might actually be the ones who really who used to really support Robert Mugabe because they were appointed by him and they owed their positions to him. Chiwenga was now on a contract that was renewed every year, like the other Defense Forces chiefs. So the truth is that there are still some people who still support him, even in the army. There are still some people who still support him. So we don't really know. Remember in 2013, the same thing happened. Joyce Mujuru also was chucked out and Mnangagwa came in.
There have been in the past anti-government protests. They've been sizable at times. So presumably there is a concern at the top of ZANU-PF that any criticism of the government that goes unchecked could encourage more of those protesters out onto the streets.
Yeah, that fear is quite real because we do have a huge population of vendors on the streets of Harare during the day and even throughout the night, there are people selling on the streets of Harare. So it's likely that they would want to ensure that it's contained so that if anything happens, you don't end up with a huge population of people also taking to the streets and demonstrating.
Grace, thank you very much for your time this evening. That's Grace Mutando, who's a writer based in Harare. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. Now, during the Cold War, we got used to the idea of tit-for-tat expulsions of American and Russian spies. But now it seems the media is the new battleground between the two great powers. After the United States forced RT and a news agency Sputnik to register as foreign agents, Russia has confirmed it's considering similar measures aimed at US and other foreign media in its borders. Well, to discuss this latest twist in what is a rather fast-moving media war, I'm joined now by James Rogers, who's the head of international journalism studies at City University here in London. James, 5 years ago, Russia passed a law that required foreign-funded non-governmental organizations to register as foreign agents. It didn't apply to the media. So presumably this is just a case of extending that law.
Well, yes, it is, but it's also, unfortunately, I mean, from a journalistic point of view, it's part of a bigger picture where news organizations are really becoming involved in this souring of diplomatic relations between Russia and the West. This seems to the possible move against CNN and other Western organizations based in Russia seems to have been pretty much directly prompted by the requirement that RT, or Russia Today as it was formerly known, register in the United States. And it seems that once both countries have gone down this path, it seems it's going to be rather difficult to stop it going further, unfortunately.
Of course, Washington has accused RT and Sputnik of spreading fake news, spreading propaganda. Now, that is a charge it is harder to make, credibly, against an organization like CNN or Radio Free Europe, though presumably the way it would be presented in Russia is that what we would see as neutral reporting on the allegations of Russian interference would to them be proof of bias.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think the thing is that Western media organizations are to a very large extent seen in Russia, rightly or wrongly in my opinion, in very much the same way as Sputnik and RT are seen in the West. I mean, they're not. I mean, one of the things that Radio Free Europe perhaps hasn't got in its favor to such an interpretation is the fact that it is funded by the US Congress, and the Russians will say, well, look, and of course RT claims that it's not funded directly from the Russian government, but there are very few people who believe that. So I think they really think they're dealing with like. That said, of course, the whole raison d'etre of these media organizations, RT, when it was set up a little over 10 years ago, was to give a sort of positive view of Russia to Western audiences, a positive view which Russia felt at the time those Western audiences, international audiences, simply weren't getting from the international channels like BBC World News and CNN. So it's always been very much a part of portraying a positive image of Russia around the world.
We hear that organizations like CNN and the like could be targeted if this law is extended in Russia. What about other broadcasters who have a presence in Moscow, like the BBC or Deutsche Welle? Are they going to be nervous about this?
I think that they probably will be. You may remember a year or so ago, there was this curious story about RT saying that it had been told that its bank accounts here in the UK were going to be frozen. And that seemed to sort of, it was never clear, and the Russians were saying, well, this has obviously come from a political directive, and then the bank which was providing these facilities for RT said later, oh no, this actually wasn't going to happen. It was all very murky, and it was very difficult to disentangle where exactly the truth lay. At that time, though, the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, said in Moscow that the BBC Russian service had better watch out. Now, nothing has come of that yet, but obviously, I think it's deeply troubling that news organizations are being caught up in this the way that they are. I mean, this is very interesting, of course. We read very often that President Trump and President Putin are best mates and they're getting on so terribly well. But if you look at the actual state of US-Russia relations, it's really not that good at all at the moment. And this is obviously, media organizations may well suffer in consequence of that.
And certainly some of those media organizations may well expect the US president to defend their First Amendment rights, though you would imagine they would get a pretty short hearing from Donald Trump.
Well, that's another problem. And, you know, you have this sort of unprecedented opposition to, you know, to the media in this particular president. And of course, pretty much every president of every country has had their run-ins with the media from time to time. It's very difficult to see, though, you know, in a country such as the United States, where a free press has historically been prized as a cornerstone of their democracy, right back to the age of Thomas and Jefferson and the founding fathers. It's difficult to think of another president who has been so openly opposed to that kind of press simply because it has chosen to be critical of him. So I can't imagine that the next time that Mr. President Trump meets President Putin, he's necessarily going to be making every effort to try to defend U.S. media organizations, particularly CNN, with whom he's had a lot of disagreements, if indeed CNN do turn out to suffer in consequence of these moves we're seeing at the moment.
Now, last week, Vladimir Putin said that the United States was using the allegations of colossal doping in sport by Russia as an attempt to interfere in the elections in Russia next year. And you can't help thinking that this as well is part of a similar narrative that they're trying to build up of the Russian government having to defend itself against unfair smears from the US and other countries.
Well, that's really been one of the sort of central planks of Mr. Putin's domestic policy ever since he first came to the top of Russian politics 25 years ago. If in the first few years, you know, when Russia was still in its immediate post-Soviet stage, was still trying to build bridges and make friends with the West, obviously that relationship has got significantly worse, particularly over the last 10 years or so. And for his domestic audiences, Mr. Putin has played it very much in those terms. He's used the post-Cold War eastwards expansion of NATO as proof that everybody's against Russia, and indeed the doping allegations and the bans that Russian athletes have suffered are in many quarters in Russia seen very much as part of that too.
James, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time this evening. James Rogers, Head of International Journalism Studies at City University here in London. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, rows over controversial statues have seen demonstrations in many parts of the United States, some of them turning violent. Well, now New York is looking at its own monuments, checking for any that could be offensive to modern eyes. And later this month, the city's inhabitants will get to have their say. Joining us now from our New York bureau is Brian Butcher, senior writer at ArtNet News. Brian, one wouldn't necessarily think of New York as being home to a vast number of offensive statues, though that may just be me showing off some sort of metropolitan bias.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are several that are quite clearly really troubling. I mean, there's a statue devoted to J. Marion Sims, who is described as a pioneering gynecologist, but he performed experiments on enslaved women without anesthesia. The first one that Mayor Bill de Blasio mentioned is a small plaque that's in the sidewalk in Lower Manhattan that is devoted to Philippe Pétain, who worked with the Vichy government. So, you know, there are some that are pretty obvious. We do not exactly have large equestrian statues devoted to Confederate generals. That much is true.
But now, what's interesting is obviously that the statue debate has taken on a great deal of momentum in the last year, couple of years, but those statues have stood in a bastion of liberalism that is New York City up until this point.
Well, that also, I think, is a bit of an oversimplification. We do have, a great number of extremely wealthy people who probably want to hold on to as much of their money as they can and not have it redistributed by Democrats. And also, if you go to Staten Island and places like Staten Island and the Rockaways, there is a large population of firefighters and policemen who tend to skew more Republican.
Now, this is a public consultation and with a meeting in each of the five boroughs. Is the idea that if a momentum builds up, that they will then seriously examine the removal of some of these statues?
I imagine so, but they're definitely not committing to any particular actions. I mean, Mayor de Blasio first tweeted, you know, one of the first ones that we're going to look at is this plaque to Philippe Pétain, and there was some sort of blowback. I cannot imagine what sort of blowback there was against a Nazi sympathizer, but they really dialed it back from that and said, you know, this committee is going to make recommendations on how we might think through this. So they're not making any promises.
Now, further south, the counter argument that some have made is that you can't pretend that the less admirable or questionable elements of any country's history never existed, which is perhaps what you are doing when you expunge those statues because they don't meet modern standards.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think erasing history is just not possible, and I don't think that there are really huge amounts of the American population who learn their history via monuments. I mean, hopefully they learned it in history classes and from books, and so, and I think it could be, these things could be very safely moved to battlegrounds, historic battlegrounds. People also talk about, you know, there's a big chant of put them in museums. Well, my colleague Ben Davis wrote about how Dylann Roof, who shot up this church in the South in the hopes of starting a race war, went to a Confederate flag museum for inspiration. So there's just no easy answers. But erasing history really doesn't seem to be possible.
Now, presumably looking forward, when you talk about future monuments, the idea is that you would now draw the possibilities from a far wider range of potential candidates than in the past.
Certainly. And just to backtrack a little bit to your previous question, I mean, people who talk about how you can't erase our history say, well, this is, you know, Southern heritage and Southern history that has to be honored. And what those people leave out, of course, is that millions and millions of Southerners were enslaved Black people. So I think more people of color and more women, of course, should be under consideration to have monuments erected to them, if not to replace the ones that people find objectionable. And I think many people have also said, well, you know, these monuments are a form of public art. Why not draft artists to propose projects that would take their place on these pedestals?
Now, of course, history is always being revised down the line. I mean, there are certain, it's stunning, I think, to many people that people thought in the 60s it was appropriate to put up statues of Robert E. Lee. But, of course, there's always a chance that 100 years from now, people might look at some of the statues that we've erected during our time and gone, what on earth were they thinking?
I suppose that's true. You know, one of the people on this commission that the city has formed, a commission that has 90 days to conduct these hearings and to think about it, Darren Walker, the head of the Ford Foundation, he said, you know, we know this is going to be a thankless task. And so not only thankless, but you're absolutely right. In 100 years, they may say just that, quite right.
It's a fascinating debate nonetheless, though. I will have to leave it there, Brian. Thank you very much. Brian Bridges, senior writer at ArtNet News. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, to Portugal next, where there's been outrage over the use of a national monument there as the venue for a banquet. It was to mark the end of a Web Summit in Lisbon, but the choice of the national pantheon, resting place of many of Portugal's most significant people, saw the Prime Minister describe the decision to stage it there as offensive. Well, the organisers have since apologised. Earlier, Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke to Roger Boys, diplomatic editor of The Times, and Florence Biddema, who's the AFP London bureau chief, and asked what kind of historic venue is appropriate for a modern-day showcase.
Well, if you see Pantheon as a symbol of something serious attached to the identity of the nation, for example, I wouldn't imagine such an event in the French Pantheon. But, I mean, I guess it's also a question of money, how much was paid, I mean, to use this building. Are countries ready to negotiate on the use of such national symbol? I mean, it happened here in the UK when there was this Gucci catwalk in Westminster Abbey, which from a French point of view was a bit surprising, because I never heard of this in a church or in an abbey in France. But I mean, it all depends on how you consider your national pride and where you put your symbols, I guess.
Is it weird, notwithstanding the questions of national pride, which we will get to shortly, but the idea of having a banquet or indeed a catwalk parade effectively surrounded by dead people?
Well, you know, everyone to their taste. It was sort of Halloweenish time, wasn't it? I mean, I'm just happy that there are countries in the world who still think of some buildings as still being sacred. I mean, here everything is absolutely for sale, for hire, and for rent. So, you know, perhaps I'm just being an old fuddy-duddy, but, you know, how many parties have I been to at the National History Museum standing next to a dinosaur? You know, this poor skeletal creature. I just think, yeah, there are places that can be considered sacred. We have bingo sessions in English churches, but we don't have them in English mosques. And therefore, there is certainly a segment of our community that considers some things to be off bounds and good for them.
It is. It's a weird one, though, isn't it, Florence? Because there's not a one size fits all template for this. I was trying to think of Australian examples, and there was one quite recently where the custodians of Uluru, formerly known as Ayers Rock, finally decided to stop people from climbing on it. For years, the system has been that there's signs up there saying that the local Aboriginal guardians of the land regard it as sacred and would prefer it if you didn't climb on it. But people were doing it anyway.
Yeah, but I'm sure in any country there are places which nobody would touch. I mean, you give the example of Portugal. I cannot imagine a catwalk in the sanctuary of Fatima, for example. I mean, it depends on where you put the level of acceptance and what is really a national symbol. I mean, what is really representing a country and touching its heart. I mean, I wouldn't imagine maybe a catwalk in Buckingham Palace or...
It will happen.
That's probably been done. I mean, how do you define, though, Roger, a sacred space? I'm also thinking of, just in London, there's been a couple of occasions where the cenotaph has been at the centre of brouhaha of one sort or another. Once when a somewhat silly television programme filmed a car stunt in its vicinity, and another time when some idiot demonstrator decided to swing off it.
Yes. I mean... it's a question of offence, isn't it? Where the levels of what causes... I mean, you'd, for example, if you decided to party at the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, you would be arrested. And you'd be arrested because you would offend people, offend Germans, but also because you would send... But also you would do reputational damage to yourself around the world. I think that's quite a significant ban. And so we have to sit down and say, well, what does the cenotaph actually represent to us? Is it just a stone? Does that stone only gain significance on some days of the year? It's these kind of things we have to talk out and think through. But we don't have that kind of debate anymore.
And that was Roger Boys and Florence Bielemann speaking to Monocle's Andrew Muller earlier today on Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world. Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product, and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I design because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design program Section D delves deep into the places, communities, and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
Now, the British filmmaker Asif Kapadia is best known for portrayals from real life with documentaries like Amy and Senna, but now they've directed two episodes of the new Netflix series Mindhunter, which is inspired by real-life criminal profiles from the FBI's Behavioural Science Unit. It's an attempt to understand the minds of some of the most violent of criminals. Well, Monocle's Carlotta Ribeiro sat down with Asif to talk about the project and the rest of his career to date.
My background was originally in drama, and I've made feature films, but in the last few years I made Senna and Amy. And the interesting thing that came about when I met with David, when I first met David in LA, and he had talked to me about maybe being a part of the team. And I said, I don't know if you know this, David, but I've just spent like 7 or 8 years of my life making these two films, and mainly where most of my work went into doing audio interviews and meeting people just with a tape recorder and a microphone, and I would sit there and I would talk to them, and I would try to get into their mind. I would try to understand their psychology and try to understand what their part of the story was. And then I'd meet someone else and they'd say absolutely the opposite. And mine was to go away to process what they'd said, look at the transcript and try to piece together the story. In the case of Amy, a young girl who died, the idea was to try to understand how did this happen, why did this happen? You know, and it was because of a one investigation, we then go away and we put stickers up on the wall or cards and try to piece together the narrative. So that was the script for Mindhunter. I was saying to David, well, this is what I've been doing for the last few years of my life. This is actually really quite personal. The whole concept of understanding what happened and understand the brains and psychology and, you know, in many ways dealing with narcissists and sociopaths and psychopaths maybe was something that I'm fascinated by, but it's also like being my day job. So the idea of being a fiction show was something new, but also dealing with something that I'm very much aware of. And so David shot the first two episodes and the last episode, and then Andrew Douglas did 7 and 8, and they said 1, 2, 7, 8, 9, 10 had been shot before I arrived. And he was in London, so I had to fly to Pittsburgh, and then he did my block. So at that point, I had seen rushes and maybe rough cuts of 2 or 3 hours. Bits and pieces of music, and you know, David was very clever to go working, but it was done very technically in on a map. So I had seen and heard of these things, but really, you just come in and do your job. My aim was, as much as I possibly could, because I knew my episode was going to be episode 3 and 4, which would come directly after David's commentary. So people would watch the show because it's a David Simpson show, and you do episode 1 and 2. My main thing was, you watch for it after 3 and 4. Keep busy watching, and somehow make sure the story continues so that you go from the opening of the series to the middle of the show, and which brings you naturally to the climax. So I found it quite an interesting challenge to try to work with the actors and the writers to make sure 3 and 4 immediately continue the journey and the excitement for the audience so that they keep watching, and so it could not be hopefully not too noticeably different stylistically. I wanted it to feel like it was still David's show. So that was a real challenge, because it wasn't necessarily the way I would shoot or work. So I had to try to understand his techniques and the aesthetics of the show so that it felt like a smooth development and progression.
So did you feel like you were trying to physically pinpoint but actually contributing to it?
Yeah, I think that was the idea. Although it wouldn't be the same thing exactly as David does, but I couldn't anyway, even if I tried. The idea is you have absolute freedom, but there were certain lenses which were preferred for close-ups. So it's not a hand-held show, it's not a steady-cam show. You know, there are certain things which they were like, this is not how we're going to be working. So for me, it's about trying to learn the techniques, learn from the crew how things are done. So that how does David do things that he does? And I would then include them to direct, but also know that there is a particular look that is developing from the show. For example, the room, their office downstairs in the basement. At the end of episode 2, they literally open the door and they see the basement that's full of stuff. Already 7, 8, 9, 10 had been shot, but that had become their office with lots of desks and people and computers, and they're all in rooms. So for me, it's like, well, where should we take them in episode 3 and 4? It was the beginning of their workspace, which is all based on a real place that actually existed in the basement at Quantico. And that's the fun part of it. It's almost like you have a puzzle where you've got the kind of the edge of the jigsaw puzzle, and we sort of come in and fill in the middle.
That's Asif Kapadia talking there about the new Netflix series Mindhunter with Monocle's Carlotta Ribella. Well, let's take a look now at some of the big stories across Asia. My guest in the studio, Carla Bonoda, who's a senior teaching fellow in Southeast Asian politics at SOAS, University of London. Thank you for coming in this evening. Let's begin with the ASEAN summit. And firstly, the fact that it was largely fairly silent on the violence associated with the Philippines drug war.
Yes, the Philippines is giving up, excuse me, the chairmanship of ASEAN this year. It's going to Singapore, and in the summit that took place on Monday, the ASEAN as an organization acted the way it always does. This is the Association for Southeast Asian Nations, and that is to say nothing about the internal politics of its other states. Formally, there's a non-interference clause within the charter of the organization, but I don't think we have to appeal to that in terms of understanding the politics here. There are a number of autocratic states across the region. All of them are exposed to the same type of criticisms regarding human rights or questions of the rule of law. And in this case, in terms of Duterte's own actions with regard to the drug war and the number of killings that have extrajudicial killings that have taken place, he could have been easily open for criticism from the United States, which did not happen, and also from ASEAN itself, also absent.
Why is that? Because I understand that there is this clause about not interfering in other countries' internal affairs, but this is so outside of the ordinary actions of a leader.
For Southeast Asia, in fact, there's a precedent in terms of in Thailand in 2003, Thaksin Shinawatra, when he took power, he also engaged in a brutal drug war, not as extensive as this. However, I think that there is simply the lack of will for ASEAN to be anything but an economic club. And political elites in the region recognize, like I said a second ago, criticisms would start to flow about one country's internal politics, then it would be back and forth. There's nothing really keeping the organization together. And also, I think we should be very serious that the editorial here that we're looking at calls attention to the fact that there was no criticism and bemoans the fact that there was no criticism. But ASEAN never works like that. It's never a political forum. It's always, in some ways, an economic one.
In which case, it raises a question about, so beyond being a sort of an economic talking shop, what the point of it is.
What is the point of ASEAN? I think many people have asked this question. There's an aspirational element to it among the political elite within the region. The average Southeast Asian doesn't know what ASEAN is because it has no effect on their lives. And in this regard, ASEAN will never be a wedge for political progress in the region.
Now, another issue that didn't really attract a great deal of attention or criticism was Aung San Suu Kyi and the Rohingya crisis.
This is a crisis which continues to develop. She came under fire from Antonio Guterres, the head of the UN, at the summit. And although if you look at the statements are very formulaic. They want Aung San Suu Kyi to be able to implement the memorandum of understanding that was put in place a little bit ago. Indonesia especially is very forceful on this point, and certainly Malaysia, which has been the most critical of all the ASEAN states, has been arguing that the language in the article here is that this is an embarrassment for the region, although you could argue that Duterte, that this drug war is also an embarrassment for the region. And so she did not have a very easy time of it. It doesn't help that today there was a report that came out that exonerated the military of any wrongdoing in the crisis, the military's own report, or that the head of the operation has just been removed and Aung San Suu Kyi or the government has not properly given any explanation for this. So it seems that this is, in terms of diplomacy, there's a lot of diplomacy going on. But again, exactly in the case of the Philippines and the drug wars and the killings there, no progress on the ground.
Now let's stick with the summit, because there was some progress on a trade deal, but even that's been interpreted in some respects as it's just evidence that America is no longer influential.
Yes, this is the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. So in Southeast Asia, among political elites in Southeast Asia, I would argue that this is the only region of the world in which there's still a healthy appetite for what we could call trade multilateralism, for these big regional trade deals, neoliberal trade deals. And in that regard, I think the region is remarkable. However, there's no question of trade that isn't also a question of geopolitics. And the United States pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was the rival deal to what's known as RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. And on the ground at these summits, there was a scheduled meeting for the TPP members minus the United States. That did not happen. And instead, we had this press release and actually a formal summit of all of nations, which are all the Southeast Asian countries plus six others, including China, Japan, and India. And this demonstrates a political commitment to a process which could be the second largest trading organization with half the world's population. It's a big deal, although I'm not sure that they'll be able to reach an agreement by the end of next year.
Well, let's move away from the summit to Thailand, warning of IS fighters potentially in the country.
Yes, this is an interesting claim. I'm not sure exactly what Deputy Prime Minister Prawit was trying to achieve by this, because it would raise, I think, all types of concerns by investors or even regionally in terms of people watching terrorism. However, it seems as if he was speaking slightly off the cuff. There were no details as to the presence of the terrorists in the country. What the military is trying, and the police actually, the Thai police are trying to do right now, is to round up about 100,000 people who have overstayed their visa last year. And they are worried that some of these people are engaged in organized crime and that some of them may be terrorists. So I wouldn't argue that this is the headline was that the Islamic State is in the in the country, but I think this is probably loose rhetoric designed to justify the crackdown as opposed to alert us to any possible terrorist threats.
If you were looking for a pretext to launch a crackdown, then saying IS is probably the safest way to do that at the moment.
Exactly, with no political consequences whatsoever, because the threat seems completely vague. There has been, I mean, the insurgency in southern Thailand is very significant, you know, it's very important. It has gone on since 2004. About 7,000 people have been killed. There is a kind of Islamist element to, one of the elements is an Islamist element. However, it's never really been internationalized. So for the military to, because it said, he said ISIS is in the country, there's already been 100 arrests related to visa violations in the south so far. To kind of conflate the two together is a little bit of sleight of hand.
Better news from Thailand, particularly if you're vegetarian. It is now apparently the friendliest country in the region for people who eschew meat.
Friendliest country in the region. The metrics for this were how many vegetarian restaurants were there in the country, how much meat per year was consumed per capita, and there's one other metric that I can't remember right now. I wholeheartedly disagree with this report. I believe Malaysia by far is the easiest place to be a vegetarian. For me, the most important metric, and I'm fluent in Thai, so this is an issue of reading menus or whatever. The most important metric is when you're off the beaten path, how hard is it to grab a quick vegetarian meal? And it's still harder in Thailand than
Well, that is always, I mean, the stereotype is that you go somewhere, certainly in Britain, and you know, what's the vegetarian option? And it's a salad.
Or these ridiculous veggie burgers that's just potatoes and peas, you know.
So is that still the case in Thailand, that it's actually a bit tricky?
I think that for tourists, if you are outside of a tourist area, it's much, much harder, and you don't speak Thai, it's much, much harder to be a vegetarian in Thailand than it is in Malaysia, where there's actually a wide diversity of food. But actually, I'm making this complaint about, or not complaint, I'm making this statement about Thailand, but in both countries, if you go to good Chinese Buddhist restaurants or good vegetarian restaurants, usually the quality of the vegetarian food is much, much better than you get here in the United Kingdom. And I wouldn't complain in either, being in either country right now, eating.
At this time of night. Well, it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from a 1980s pop star, early 80s synth star Gary Numan, who was once asked in an interview, did he agree with Morrissey, singer of the Smiths, who said that meat is murder, and he just said, it always is when it gets stuck between your teeth. Carlo, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for coming in this evening. That brings us to the end of this Monocle Daily, produced by Tom Hall, researchers Daphne Carnesis and Alessia Delano, our studio manager, Sarah Miles. Georgina Godwin here for The Globalist at 7 a.m. London time. I'll be back 2200 tomorrow here in London for another Monocle Daily. We will stay on that vegetable and vegetarian theme as we play out on green onions. See the link there? From Booker T and the MGs. From me, Paul Osborne. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.